You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, in Praise of Fractals, we feature poems about math and physics by Emily Grossholtz.
How shall we study the morphology of the amorphous? Mandelbrot solved the conundrum by inventing fractals, a lineage of shapes fretted by chance, whose regularities are all statistical, like Brownian motion.
Curving space-time in the lab using superconducting quantum interference devices.
One idea would be to create a situation that would mimic the inflation in the early universe, in which the space-time rapidly expands.
And searching for the impossible, calculating which quantum problems can never be solved.
It's about the very foundations of quantum mechanics and our description of reality. And here, to understand the differences between the quantum world and the classical world is, of course, very important.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali. Welcome to the latest podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. In this edition, we're taking a more contemplative slant by featuring some poetry about physics, mathematics, and the people who work on them, along with our usual mix of recent research in fundamental physics.
Yes, indeed, we are taking a more contemplative slant because I recently visited Penn State University, where I had the pleasure of meeting Emily Grossholtz, a philosopher of mathematics, science, and other subjects at the university. She's also a poet and has written a number of pieces inspired by the history of physics, by modern research, and also by the sociology of science. So, we thought we would share a few of them with you now. The first one we'll listen to was inspired by a meeting with mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot, who developed fractal geometry. Here's Grossholtz, who begins by explaining the thinking behind her poem, In Praise of Fractals.
I wrote this poem, In Praise of Fractals, because I was invited to be part of an event with Benoit Mandelbrot. Quite a few years ago, I was invited by the chemist and poet, Roald Hoffman, and the event was very interesting, but I felt that I should write something for it. So I read through The Fractal Geometry of Nature by Mandelbrot, which was published in 1983, and then I took some of the ideas and vocabulary and I wrote this poem, In Praise of Fractals. Euclid's geometry cannot describe, nor Apollonius, the shape of mountains, puddles, clouds, peninsulas, or trees. Clouds are never spheres, nor mountains cones, nor ponderosa pines. Bark is not smooth, and where the land and sea so variously lie upon each other and lightly kiss is no hyperbola. Compared with Euclid's elementary forms, nature, loosening her hair, exhibits patterns, sweetly disarrayed, afloat, uncombed, not simply of a higher degree, N, but rather of an altogether different level of complexity. The number of the scales of distances describing her is almost infinite. How shall we study the morphology of the amorphous? Mandelbrot solved the conundrum by inventing fractals, a lineage of shapes fretted by chance, whose regularities are all statistical, like Brownian motion, whose fine configurations turn out to be the same at every scale. Some fractal sets are curves, space-filling curves, or complex surfaces. Others are wholly disconnected dusts. Others are just too odd to have a name. Poincaré once observed, "There may be questions that we choose to ask, but others ask themselves, sometimes for centuries, while no one listens. Questions that ask themselves without repose may come to rest at last in someone's mind. So Mandelbrot, in time, designed his fractal brood to be admired, not merely for its formal elegance as mathematical structure, but power to interpret, curl by curl, nature's coiffure of molecules and mountains. What gentle revolution of ideas disjoins the 19th century from ours? Cantor's set of nested missing thirds, piano's curve of fractional dimension, Mandelbrot's fractals counter the old rule of simple continuity, domesticating what short-sightedly was once considered monstrous. Nature embraces monsters as her own, encouraging the pensive mathematician to find anomaly inherent in the creatures all around us. The masters of infinity, Cantor, Peano, Hausdorff, and Lebesgue, discovered sets not in the end transcendent, but immanent, Spinoza's darling cause. Imagination shoots the breeze with nature, and what they speak, mathematics, as they flirt, reveals itself surprisingly effective in science, a wrought gift we don't deserve or seek or understand. So let us just be grateful and hope that it goes on, although our joy is always balanced by our bafflement.
That was poet and philosopher Emily Grossholtz. We'll be hearing more of her poems throughout the podcast. Now, from the complex, curved geometry of fractals to curving the geometry of space-time itself. Einstein's theory of general relativity tells us that the universe is pervaded by a four-dimensional space-time fabric that warps and bends around heavy objects like stars and planets. Astronomers have seen evidence of this by looking at how the path of light traveling past cosmic objects is bent as it travels to Earth. But it would be wonderful to test what happens as space-time bends closer to home. Unfortunately, no matter how many donuts I eat, I never seem to put on enough weight to measurably curve space-time.
But at least you're trying, Brendan. That's the main thing. Now, as you say, we can't usually see the effects of warping space-time in the lab, since we can't build a giant black hole in the laboratory, for instance.
Nor would we want to.
But physicist and FQXI member Sorin Parawanu at Aalto University in Finland has a way around the problem. He's building his own model of space-time using an array of squids.
Won't they wriggle around too much and ruin the experiment? I hope the poor creatures aren't harmed in any way.
Squids, Brendan, in this case, are superconducting quantum interference devices.
I don't know what those are exactly, but at least there would be fewer ethical issues in using them.
Basically, they enable Parawanu to build an artificial space-time in the lab, which could soon be used to test the nature of space-time on the smallest scales. This could help us see how it matches up with the predictions made by theories of quantum gravity. I met with Parawanu in March at a Quantum Foundations meeting in Arice, Italy, sponsored by COST. During a coffee break in the meeting, he told me about why he and his colleagues want to mimic a curved space-time in his lab, to help them gain a better understanding of quantum gravity, and also to help us learn about how the early universe expanded, in a process known as inflation.
We would need to understand really what happens when quantum physics and the general theory of relativity are merged together, or they are forced to act together in the same experimental context. And in nature, this happens only at the event horizon of a black hole, which unfortunately is inaccessible so far to some real experimental or observational tests. And so we simply want to recreate the same phenomenon in the lab somehow, to put together the predictions of quantum physics and those coming from having a curved space-time background.
And so in your laboratory, what is it that plays the role of space-time, and how do you go about curving it?
The type of samples that we are studying are made as an array of squids. And this creates effectively a one-dimensional space-time background for the one-dimensional propagating fields, which are photons that travel along this array of squids.
So you're going to have to remind me what SQUID stands for. I think it's superconducting quantum something device. So, you know, what is it and how is it you're able to kind of control its properties?
Well, SQUID is a quantum interferometer device which is simply made of two Josephson junctions that are realized in parallel. So you tune externally some magnetic field, the magnetic field that pierces the SQUID loop, and this changes the effective Josephson energy, which in turn enters in the calculation of the speed of light that propagates in this chain of, in this array of SQUIDs, which in turn gives you the metric. The speed of light enters as the metric of the space-time. So we can change the speed of light or the metric locally or globally.
So when we talk about real curved space-time, you know, one of the things is that the path of light that's moving through it will be affected by this curvature. So, you know, that will be modified. And in your lab, you know, the hope is to create a material made up of sort of a chain of SQUIDs, which can each be controlled so that you can modify the path of light, the path of photons as they move through.
Yes, that's correct. So one can in principle think also of two-dimensional arrays of SQUIDs in which the path of the photon is controlled. But in our case, the system is one-dimensional. So what we are interested so far is in time-dependent phenomena. What happens when we change very fast the speed of light in some place, or when you make a change in the speed of light and move this change along the material, so to speak.
Now, Soren, obviously, you know, it takes a huge amount of energy to actually curve space-time. We're talking about things like black holes out in space that usually have enough mass to create enough gravity to curve space-time. So how can you recreate something that has a similar effect in your laboratory?
That's right. Our space-time is, in fact, an artificial space-time. It's an effective space-time that is felt by the fields that propagate in media. And the magic is coming from the strength of the electromagnetic field. The gravitational field is much weaker. Therefore, the action of actually curving the space-time, so actually curving the background that photons, for instance, would see when propagating, is indeed weak. So you need to have a lot of mass to do something that is experimentally or measurable at all or observable at all. But in the lab, because the electromagnetic field is so strong, we actually can bend this effective space-time in a much more effective way. We don't need to go to extremely high fields. We just need to use the electric fields that you would normally use anyway in a laptop.
And so how far have you got so far in kind of building this kind of material?
We can make this arrays of SQUIDs. We definitely can make them and we can study them. There's a lot of work done in characterization of these structures and in understanding actually what are their properties at microwave frequencies. And there is some work that we should do in fighting with the coherence, improving the quality of the materials. And that there is some further work that we should really think what are the limitations of, for instance, if we do experiments on propagating the bias pulses along the line, how in practice we can do this and what are the limitations and what we would realistically expect to see. But there is a lot of very interesting physics, I should say, along each of these steps. It's not like we are having a goal that is 20 years ahead. It's at each step we really discover very beautiful physics and very fundamental physics.
And so when it is all up and running, you know, what will be the sort of the first things that you plan to test, and how will that relate to our understanding of quantum theory combined with the general theory of relativity?
One idea would be to create a situation that would mimic the inflation in the early universe, in which the space-time rapidly expands. And then we should see the creation of photons in our case. In the inflationary model, it's matter that is created and also photons. But that would be one of our first experiments to do, and we are probably not very far from that.
Thank you to Soren Parawanu for chatting to Zia there. You can hear an extended version of his interview on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast, where Parawanu talks about testing the Landau-Zehner formula for transition probabilities between the states of an atom. This could have implications for amplifying the quantum vacuum.
On the podcast page, you'll also find a link to an article on his research by Nicola Jones and a podcast interview from 2013 in which Parawanu talks about experiments that use the dynamical Casimir effect to transform virtual photons in the vacuum into real photons.
Parawanu's chain of squids mimics a curved spacetime by manipulating the refractive index of light within the material. Which brings us back to poet and philosopher Emily Grossholtz, who has been looking back at Isaac Newton's work on optics and the reaction to it by the German writer Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Here's Grossholtz introducing her poem, The Dissolution of the Rainbow.
In the past few decades, I've actually worked quite a bit on Newton and Newton's Principia and Newton's physics and the way in which mathematics and metaphysics and physics interact to produce that great work. But I've also, on the side, done a bit of work on his optics because there's some interesting mathematics in his optics. And then I came to realize that there was a great controversy, in retrospect, between Newton and Goethe. Goethe, in his Farbenlehre, the theory of colors, really gives Newton a hard time, a century later. Goethe wrote, "By an extraordinary combination of circumstances, the theory of colors has been drawn into the province and before the tribunal of the mathematician, a tribunal to which it cannot be said to be amenable." So I read about that controversy, and I had some sympathy on both sides. And so the result was this poem, The Dissolution of the Rainbow. A cut glass chandelier dangled above the desk where Newton read and wrote. All morning, spectral dragons fought, mocked him, and made love across the white wall opposite, flashed their blue and sea-green scales, the fur of tiny fires, a glittering red eye light. Then one day they suddenly fled and no longer were. Rising in impatience, strangely lit by reason, the philosopher undid, prism by prism, the trembling chandelier to run her now constrained and broken offspring through a maze of barriers. The light went through its paces, but the dragons disappeared. What remains, Sir Isaac quantified, teaching nature not to sing her sweeter variations, but in one low tone, geometry, to answer him. Although white light is manifold, a mixture, so he found, of different rays, each ray could be identified, in essence, with its angle of refraction. This was the only origin of colors, color then reduced to numbering. The dragons lapsed to silence, mortified, curled up and dry as worms a child has questioned in the fire of curiosity and left behind. When Newton set his prism work aside, he wiped his hands and wrote on creamy paper long and elegant formulae, a shadow of the sensuous retained in his illuminating study, even that much immaterial. Yet he sometimes noticed, later on, how his sines and cosines lay across the paper like dark skeletons of dragon, couchant, rampant, as the full, proud curve of the integral.
Thank you again to Emily Grossholtz for reading her poem, The Dissolution of the Rainbow. Now, Brendan said that we were being more contemplative in this edition of the podcast, and indeed we are. Our next item features complexity theorist and FQXI member Jens Eisert, who's taking a step back from solving specific quantum problems to ask a more abstract question. Is there a way of calculating which problems are undecidable? An endeavour that could have repercussions for those building quantum computers and working in cryptography.
Eisertz, who is currently based at the Free University of Berlin, likens his work to that of a detective. But the crime stories he seeks are the most complex types of computational problems, those that are actually impossible to compute because they would leave a machine calculating for infinite time. Reporter Sophie Hebden asked him how he approaches his work as a detective come physicist.
We approach the problem from different sides, and it's a very complicated, elaborate action, meaning that several steps are needed, and in a way, all do all these steps at the same time to make sure that it all comes together. Spend loads of time together at the blackboard. I have 12 meters of blackboard in our discussion room, and I spend like 5 hours a day in that room. And the rest I hide somewhere in my building, not in my office, to get my calculations done in secret places that my colleagues find me and say, oh, don't you have an office? Yes, I do have an office, but thank you. But I'm not in it because then people find me. We spend a lot of time talking about that together and try to crack the crime story. Sometimes, most crime stories you can read to the end and then you know the answer. And here it can happen that you don't know the answer. So it's a possibly open-ended crime story. It's part of the charm.
The open-ended aspect of Eisertz's crime stories is exactly what interests him. These are problems that are so complex they will never be resolved because they are impossible for a computer to give a yes or no answer. So they are called undecidable. Alan Turing first identified the limits of what a machine can compute nearly 80 years ago, when he proved that it is impossible for a computer to tell you whether a program will halt on some input or continue running forever, the so-called halting problem. Eisertz is searching for similarly undecidable problems, except that he is focusing on problems in the quantum world. I asked him where his interest in undecidable quantum problems began.
I mean, the starting point where really my interest in the foundations of quantum mechanics on the one hand, and the type of question one usually asks in quantum information theory, namely of the type, like what the ultimate limits are of physical processes and our classical descriptions of these processes. Yeah, so there's a famous book by John Bell on what is speakable and not, but he had something very precise in mind, namely, to what extent classical descriptions of quantum mechanics or classically statistical descriptions of quantum mechanics can be done or not, and what one can speak about quantum mechanics in classical statistical terms. But, I mean, here the question popped up again, but in a different reading with a different meaning, namely, things can be unspeakable, but not because there's the classical language is inappropriate or so, but rather because there are problems that are undecidable in quantum mechanics. So you cannot speak about them because you cannot come up with an answer to the problem. It's not so much about quantum theory, but about our descriptions of quantum theory. It's about the very foundations of quantum mechanics and our description of reality. And here, to understand the differences between the quantum world and the classical world is, of course, very important for purely foundational reasons. In quantum information theory, it's very common to look at physical processes and operations with the eyes of computer science and ask what type of problems should be kind of easy or hard.
Computer scientists want to identify how complex a problem is to know whether it's worth giving up trying to compute it. Interestingly, computational complexity can be very different for quantum systems compared to classical systems. You might already be familiar with this difference when it comes to factoring, the process of finding the different combinations of numbers that multiply together to produce a given larger number. Factorization is considered a hard problem because it is too difficult for classical computers to do in a reasonable amount of time. So it's the basis for how we make secure transactions over the internet. But a quantum computer could do factoring easily, so people are concerned about the security risk that quantum computers could pose. Eisertz has found a problem that goes the other way around, where the problem is doable in the classical world, but impossible to compute in the quantum world.
A thing everybody knows in physics is what the so-called Stern-Gerlach device is. It's a measurement apparatus. Say it's like a box, and a particle can fly in, like an electron. What the machine does is it does a measurement. It measures the state of the electron, and according to the measurement outcomes, the particle would fly out of several possible holes, like five. So I now give you such a machine, such a device, and give you also the classical description of the device. So I tell you precisely how it's built and what it measures. Now I allow you to do experiments with that, maybe in your head, like a thought experiment. You can use this device many times, but it's always the same device, meaning you have a measurement apparatus of that type. The particle flies out and flies again into an apparatus of exactly the same type. So the input of one is the output of the next. So the point of quantum measurement theory is now to say with what probability the particle will fly out through what port. Quantum mechanics is an intrinsically probabilistic theory. You can never know what happens in one shot, but it gives you the probability of it happening, and then you can verify that through many repetitions of the same experiment. So I can ask loads of questions. One of the most meaningful and presumably simplest questions is to ask, is there somewhere an empty port, meaning no matter in what state the particle flies in, it will never fly out to that port? And one would think there's also a simple answer to the question. The surprise is that is precisely a question that turns out to be undecidable. You cannot find out. If you want to check, you want to switch on your computer and want to find out whether this is the case or not, the machine will run forever and will never spit out a conclusive answer to the question.
Isert and his colleagues then considered what would happen if the Stern-Gerlach-type devices make a classical measurement instead of a quantum measurement. This changes the mathematics for describing how the devices work, honing it down to a subset of the quantum behavior and making the problem perfectly decidable.
Even classically, it's still a probabilistic problem. It's still an apparatus where the particle flies in and it flies out with some probability. But the way the probability in the next round comes about is different in quantum mechanics than in classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, it's all about probability vectors. There's no phases entering. There's no constellations that can occur. Whereas in the classical world, it's all positive numbers. And the positivity of all the probability vectors that are entering eventually makes it a decidable problem.
Isert and his colleagues showed that the undecidable nature of the quantum case is a genuinely quantum mechanical feature.
So there's a rather deep link between questions of computational complexity, like in technical terms, and physical processes that are actually happening in nature. I'd have another example, but that's not our example, but maybe by Toby Cubitt and Michael Wolf and David Perez-Garcia, who have a very nice result, which is not yet published, which proves the undecidability of the spectral gap. What is meant by that? Think of a quantum many-body system like some metal, something that's just sitting around. These things are quantum systems with many degrees of freedom, which interact locally, meaning the positively charged ions in that crystal, say, they sit in some lattice structure, but they only see their neighbors and interact with their neighbors. That's very common in condensed matter physics, that you have many, 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 many degrees of freedom, but they interact in a local fashion, which means that the individual constituents only see their, say, their nearest neighbors in some geometric configuration. Now, these things have ground states. That's the lowest temperature state. Interestingly, even at room temperature, a lot of the properties of such materials can be described by ground state physics. It's very important to know the ground state energy of such systems and to know whether there's a so-called spectral gap, which means that above the ground state energy, there's no energy levels in the system at all, and only at a bit of a higher energy level, namely above the energy gap, are other spectral values. And then loads of them, exponentially many of them. And whether a system is gapped in the sense or not, this makes a whole lot of a difference. Deciding whether a many-body system has a gap or not is, in fact, an undecidable problem. And then you say, oh, wait a minute, that's weird. That's in fact one of the problems I would like to know. The answer is very important, it's very physical. But by very foundational computational reasons, I cannot find the answer.
Because that has implications for people who are trying to make semiconductor-type devices and that kind of thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, of course, in the context of, well, as you say, semiconductor-type devices, this is, of course, exactly the type of question that you are interested in. And now you say, this is an undecidable problem. So what does it mean? And then arguing starts, because it's not entirely obvious what that means. First of all, it means that for many practical settings, the gap question will still be decidable. It's only in for some instances that it's really an undecidable problem. But it can also mean that it's just the wrong question. And that's one of the applications of all this. Namely, you identify whether physical questions have been the right questions in the first place. So maybe that means that asking about a gap or so is not really the interesting question to ask. The gap is not a perfectly clean definition, because it turns out to be, in this sense, an undecidable question. So one might need to revisit some definitions and carefully assess whether some refinement of common definitions is needed. And that's also a part of the motivations, of the portfolio of motivations for that program.
Isaac carries on looking for puzzles when he leaves the office, because he loves architecture and enjoys knowing how to date buildings by their appearance.
You show me a house and I tell you in what year it was built, and then the predictive power is rather high. Like from 1300 on, you can predict the date of the building like up to a certainty of like 20 years.
Wow, that's pretty good.
And that's pretty, I mean, what I find interesting about it is, first, you can do it. Second, it shows that if you live in a certain period of life, one is usually not aware of the fact to what extent the taste of the times is ubiquitous and is shaping everything around us. It just looks normal, and we're not aware to what extent we are just guided by common aesthetical mindsets that are surrounding us.
It's a bit like your analogy of your work being like investigation of a crime. You're kind of a bit of a building sleuth as well.
It is like that. I mean, you wake up in the morning, and every morning believe that you can solve a little bit of a puzzle. Of course, it never works, but sometimes it does. But, I mean, this getting up each day and truly believing in the expectation that at that evening something important or big could have happened and some crime story puzzle could have been solved, that brings you through the day.
Thank you to Jens Eisert for explaining his research to Sophie Hebden. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find a link to an article on Eisert's research by Sophie.
Now, you might wonder how physicists feel in the face of unanswerable questions, such as those that Eisert is attempting to uncover, or how cosmologists deal with theories about the early universe, quantum gravity, and inflation that are as yet untestable. Until Paruanu and others come up with analogs in the lab to provide some experiments to help, that is. But that's the topic of our final piece from Emily Grossholtz. Here she is, once more, describing the inspiration behind her poem, Among Cosmologists.
One of my colleagues here at the Center for Fundamental Theory at the Institute for Gravitation in the Cosmos is Shara Shandera. And when she was being interviewed for the job here, I came to her lecture and I went out to dinner with her, and she said a couple of very interesting things. And I thought about them afterwards, I wrote them down, and then they turned into a poem. So this poem is called Among Cosmologists. Breathlessly, with a shrug and a vague gesture, empty hand, palm up, collecting something from empty space that is, by all accounts, not empty, rather like the four-dimensional surface of an n-dimensional cauldron, where bubbles form and wink out of existence. The young expert on galaxies suggests 100 billion. However, the next Sloan survey announces the count of galaxies, red-shifting as they leave us, past the tall, implacable, vast light cone we cannot see, but know it marks the boundaries of seeing. Doesn't it keep you up at night, this outward rush of galaxies fleeing themselves and us into the infinite arms of the multiverse? I ask. Oh, no, she answers, catching her breath. What keeps me up is our recurrent failure to know the universe before inflation or offer quantum mechanics a foundation. It's not the future, but the hidden past. It's not what's overhead, but underneath.
Thank you once more to Emily Grossholz. On the podcast page, you'll find a link to some of her anthologies, along with her other books. And you can find her on Twitter at ERG2R. Of course, you can find us there too at FQXI, and also write to us at podcast@fqxi.org.
If you want to try your hand at writing poetry, you'll also find a link to a poetry and cosmology course in the Rockies in July, run by Grossholz.
That's all for today. Thank you again to Emily Grossholz, Soren Perahuanu, Jens Eisert, and Sophie Hebden.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster. I'm off to write poetry about physics podcasting.
And I'm going to wrestle a squid.
It's a lovely image.